General Hackett, Realto.
In August 1943 these private armies that were proliferating in the Middle East at that time were being used for raids against the extensive dispositions of the Africa Corps in a theater which was ideally suited to light raiding operations. And light raiding operations are a mode of warfare which suit the British approach admirably. After all, this maritime nation has made its fortune and had its successes and some of its disasters by sea, and is accustomed to regard blue water as an open flank. And where there's an open flank, there's a chance of exploitation. And this is what this maritime nation has been trying to achieve for years. Well, now, there's the Mediterranean wide open, and where there wasn't blue water, there were mountain ranges and deserts and other inviting opportunities for flank penetration. And so, as a small raider's paradise, it was occupying quite a lot of attention. And among these forces were the Long Range Desert Group, a very highly professional outfit, admirable deep reconnaissance men. There was David Sterling's newly formed SAS, still finding its way, really. There were other ad hoc groups, some of them formed out of the Libyan Arab Force, the other groups like this group of German Jews under Jock Hazelden, who were also used in this raid on Tobruk. And there was going to be a seaborne battalion and a good deal of naval support. And this had turned out a complete disaster. The planning was wrong. The security was wrong. Everything went wrong. Jock Hazelton's Germans were massacred. The LRDG were badly handled. David Sterling's people didn't have a good time. We lost the best part of a Highland battalion, and two destroyers, Sikh and Zulu, were sunk. And, of course, the whole thing had been commanded, if that's the word I want. It's not a true suggestion of what was actually taking place, by a committee, a senior officer of each of the services, the Navy, Army, and Air Force. A committee, for goodness sake. This, by the way, thinking back on it over the years, and after a night I spent a few years ago in Fort Carlisle in the United States Army War College, sitting up all night with Charlie Baltic, who commanded the hostage rescue operation which failed in the Persian desert after the seizure of the embassy. This is exactly what went wrong with them. They tried to control an operation by share between services. Everybody wanted to share in that Persian hostage rescue operation. And the Marines, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, they all had to have a share in it. And of course the thing was a cock-up from the beginning, or very nearly the beginning, quite soon after it began. Well, anyway, the Tobruk raid also turned out a disaster. And people in GHQ, Middle East, thought, well, look, we've got to try to organize these things. If we use them, they've got to be put into some rational form. So what we want is a staff officer who's accustomed to running around the place and getting things done, has been in the desert and so on. Whom have we got? And it was Freddy de Gangon, who was Monty's chief of staff then, newly taken over. Monty, of course, didn't just arrive. He said, well, you get Shan Hackett out of the Eighth Hussars and put him in. And indeed, as Freddy says in his book Operation Victory, he said, at that time, this officer, me, was having the time of his life. So I was right about Humaimet, at the bottom end of the line, just above the sand sea, where there was a pretty free toing and froing between German light armour and ourselves. And we'd go out in the early dawn and try to pick off an eight-wheel German armoured car or something like that. It was a very sporting time of the war, that, and the last thing I wanted to do was to leave it and go and sit in a bloody office. But anyway, this is what they decided to have done. And of course, the chief of staff in GHQ Middle East at that time was Dick McCreary, whom I'd known very well when he was commanding a squadron in the 12th Lancers years before in the Cairo Cavalry Brigade, and subsequently. And Dick said, "Okay, as I know that chap, we'll have him." So I protested as loud as I could, and in particular, I remember writing a private letter to Freddy de Gangre, who was a keen racing man, and we were all getting ready for the big counteroffensive, which was going to be what turned out to be the Second Battle of Alamein. And I wrote to Freddy and said, "Look, this is nonsense. Don't let them take me away from here. You're the last person in the world not to realize that you don't take a horse busy training for the October handicap in Newbury and start him jumping instead of flat racing before he's had his race. We're getting ready for a race. Let's get on with it." But adamant, I snatched up and forced into Cairo, where they set up a thing called G raiding forces. And I had to gather this lot in together. First of all, find out what went wrong in the Tobruk business, and then make sure that it didn't, if I could prevent it, happen again. So we had to reorganize all this lot, and they were very varied lot of prima donnas. I mean, before I was through on my stint with that, we had not only the LRDG, those splendid deep reconnaissance men, a unique unit that, and David Stirling's also equally splendid but quite different SAS. They weren't reconnaissance people, they were blowers up. And whereas the reconnaissance men had to be given occasion blowing up to keep them happy, the SAS men were also capable of a bit of reconnaissance, though it wasn't their lot. Well, there were those two. Then soon there was to be formed the Greek Sacred Squadron. My goodness, that was a party. And then, before very, very long, we acquired a team of Turkish-speaking assassins called the Kalpaks, operating under a group of Greek epigraphists from Edinburgh University, whom we kept on ice to murder German generals if they got through down through the Caucasus. But of course, actually, that never happened. And there were others. There was a bunch of Greek sponge fishers whose knowledge of the inland waters of the Sirte was unequalled. And there were others besides, and they were all had to be gathered together. And my business, oh, and George Jellicoe, I mustn't forget George Jellicoe and the Special Boat Squadron, and others I haven't mentioned. And I had to gather all this lot together, find them equipment and weapons, find them things to do, try to make sure that they did it, try to make special operations comprehensible to senior commanders, and then try to make them palatable, which took a lot of doing, because they weren't an easy lot to keep under full control. But it was the greatest fun, and it was then that I hatched Popsky. Years after all this, well, not more than that many years, but in 1946, I turned up in Vienna to be head of the intelligence organization of the British element in the Allied Control Authority, ACABE, Allied Control Authority, British element. And I was the colonel then in charge of INTORG, the intelligence organization. And at that time, Popsky, we'll come back to him, but he was then a liaison officer between the commander-in-chief of British forces in Italy, who again was Dick McCreary at that time, and the Russians. Well, of course, Popsky was a chap, a Belgian national, but a Russian by birth. And he wasn't really very popular with the Russians, because he'd been fighting on what he thought was not the right side during the war. He'd been fighting for us. There he was, anyway, trying to do a difficult job. And I went into a party one evening, immediately after my arrival in Vienna, to take over this intelligence job. And there I heard a lot of people having a drink. And somebody said, "You know Popsky, I suppose." And anything further was cut short by a bellow from a bald-headed, rotund, bellicose-looking little man by the fire, who said, "Know me? Why, he invented..." Well, of course, it would have taken more fertile imagination than mine to invent Popsky's. But it is true that I found him in Cairo doing not very much shortly after the time that I went to take charge. In fact, he'd been hurt in the Tobruk raid, and he'd just come out of hospital with a grudge against the general staff and the world in general, longing to get on with the war. And he was being wasted, and so I brought Popsky in, and we soon became firm friends. And I set him up in what we called, for the benefit of the War Establishments Committee, by the somewhat pompous title of Number 1 Long Range Demolition Squadron. That was getting to take it seriously. And Dick McCready forced it through, and we got it through in lightning time, with the A and SD people saying, "Well, surely it's a little odd, isn't it, to have one officer and 18 other ranks in a..." And I believe I'm going to increase it to 2 or 3 officers for 80. Well, anyway, Dick forced it through, and in no time, Popsky was out in the desert. But not before we had a little meeting in George Davies' office. He was director of military operations. Incidentally, it was he who was the chairman of the committee which was responsible for the Tobruk raid. And that was one reason why Monty would never employ Brigadier George Davies, good officer though he was, and a very fine armed brigade commander. Monty wouldn't have anybody who didn't realise that the whole essence of command in war is that it should be one person in the job. Well, in his room, we were talking about what to call Pops. You couldn't call him by this long, long name. So we argued about this, and finally I said, "Look, we're wasting a lot of time. Unless you can think of a suitable name, I'm going to call you Popsky's private army and have done with it." "Done," said Popsky. And as soon as he could, left for the souk and had those astrolabe flashes made up, and within a fortnight was out in the desert with a couple of million lire he'd managed to get me to find for him, and with 2 or 3 men. And then he went on this interesting, elaborate, and sometimes very fruitful operation, for which, unfortunately, we ran out of desert too soon, really. And so in the end, we shipped him over into Italy. But anyway, this was the outfit that I was trying to manage. And very good fun it was. I mean, one of the chief problems, for example, was to keep these little armies out of each other's way. I mean, there was the Long Range Desert Group practicing its infinitely careful, cautious, skillful reconnaissance, where on the end of a series of dumps that had taken them probably 1,000 miles around in the desert, they would end up with 2 men with a pair of binoculars and a wireless set in the vicinity on the coast road, let's say between Tripoli and Tunis, chalking up every vehicle that went down from a few hundred yards away, a beautiful operation, and sending the report into GHQ Middle East that night. Beautiful. An unequalled operation in deep reconnaissance. Well, the SAS would come around and blow up some aeroplanes. I mean, David Stirling in all that time destroyed more aircraft on enemy airfields on the ground than the RAF knocked out of the sky. So much so that I put him in for a Distinguished Flying Cross. And then they discovered in the small print that it said that the operation for which the decoration was awarded had to be a flying operation. So I had to think again. We got him another DSO. But the SAS would come out to blow up some aeroplanes. They were very careless about things. Lovely men, very careless, leave a lot of stuff around. And they would stir the thing up no end, and out would come the Axis forces to see what had stirred it up, and they'd find the LRDG. Well, this is the thing that had to be prevented, so I drew a line down the map like a medieval pope separating out the Italians from the Portuguese in the Atlantic, saying, "West of this, LRDG only. East of this, SAS only." And that kept them more or less out of each other's hair. And they remain, I have to say, good friends. Well, that was fine. And David and Sturdy, David Sturdy, I became became very, very good friends. There's a remarkable interview on the record somewhere between Monty and David and me when we wanted recruits for the SAS. We only wanted the best. We wanted good sergeants out of infantry battalions. And when they joined the SAS, they'd revert to troop over. Monty, like any sensible field commander preparing for battle, didn't want his best NCOs taken out and used as troopers elsewhere. So he was very difficult to persuade to allow us to reconnoitre in his parish in Etarnia. Now, we went up to see him in Burglarum, which was where the headquarters was at the time, before Allemagne. And we pressed our plea to be allowed to recruit for this very important raiding unit. And my mandate from General Alexander, CNC, was that these raiding forces were and were to remain theatre troops. They were not to be placed under the command or at the disposal of the field commander. And in other words, they weren't to belong to his army, they were to be theatre troops, just like the bomber command. Very good. And this was my mandate, and this is what was going to happen. So Monty was very difficult to persuade. He said, and what makes you think, young Sterling, that that these men will fight better under your command than under mine? Very sarcastic stuff. And then he'd say, and anyway, they won't be ready for the next, for the battle. They won't get them trained in time for the battle. Now, the dissemination of ultra was really very, very carefully watched. And only what was absolutely essential was allowed out, down and around. Indeed, later in the war, we were going to suffer from this. But at that time, in the Middle East, very, very few people were allowed anything uncooked out of ultra. But running raiding operations, I was given a special license there and used to be given only what I needed to know, but that was certain money. And I knew what Monty's instructions from the cabinet were. When he said they won't be trained in time for the battle, I couldn't resist saying, well, they may not be trained in time for the next battle, but they'll be trained for the one after that and the battles to follow. This was too much for Monty. He hammered the table at Alamein. He said, there will be no other battle in Africa. This is going to be the last battle. My mandate is to destroy Rommel, and I propose to destroy him, he said, tapping the Alamein position, here. And this was too much for David, who was never well known for his obsequiousness to generals. And he said, oh, yes, General, but the last general told us something like that, and the one before him, too. Well, we didn't get any recruits. You won't be surprised to hear. But Monty never forgot this, and in so many occasions that brought us together, then and after the war, he's always reminding me of this argument, saying, do you remember when high words were exchanged between us at Burglarum? We nearly came to blows. Anyway, I had a sort of love-hate relationship with Monty, admired him greatly, but saw through a lot of his mistakes and vanities, as probably many people have seen through mine. Anyway, we had to go away and do what we could with what we'd got. And then they thought they needed a parachute brigade there, and they did. What they needed was a parachute brigade. In fact, had after Alamein there been a parachute brigade to put down by Capuzzo there, none of the Africa Corps would have got away. But there wasn't one. And so they agitated for one. And Monty was very anxious to have it. And there was discussion as to who would command it. I drew the short straw. And George Davies sent for me and said, we're going to raise a parachute brigade. Would you like to raise and command it? And I said, he said, you can have 2 days to think it over. I said, don't be silly. I don't need more than 2 seconds, of course. So the 4th Parachute Brigade began to be raised in the canal zone at Cambrai. And that was the way I was going to spend the rest of the fighting part of the war. First of all, putting that together with a battalion formed on a regular battalion. That was the 2nd Royal Sussex. Volunteers only, but it was thought that a battalion would be a good thing to start with, as many as would like to come. And they were turned into 10 battalion, 10th Parachute Battalion. Then there was a battalion in India, which wasn't getting very much use. 151 it was in India, a British battalion in the Indian Parachute Brigade. And that was shipped over to the Middle East and given to me, and we called it, for security reasons they changed the name, they called it 156, 156 Battalion, very, very good battalion. And we raised a completely new one called 11 Battalion. And we trained in Cabrit, occasionally dropping into Cyprus, practicing for Sicily. And then we did some more training in Palestine, and then joined up with the 1st Airborne Division, which had come out from Britain and was forming, reforming in Tunisia for the attack on the so-called soft underbelly of Europe. And that was going to be Sicily. Well, my brigade wasn't in the Sicilian thing, but I was, it was a reserve brigade. And as the divisional commander, Hopkinson, Hoppy, great man, had insisted on going off to the war himself, I was left behind as the deputy commander of the base and the remaining brigade and other divisional units that weren't being engaged in. And, of course, the airborne side of the Sicilian operation was a disaster. It was a disaster because our gliders were being pulled almost exclusively by aircraft of the United States Troop Carrier Command. And these were almost all civil airline pilots who had been trained on Randolph Field in Texas, who couldn't read maps. They were accustomed to flying on a beam, and they were flying C-47s, what we subsequently called Dakotas, C-47s that had no armored protection for the flight crew and didn't even have self-sealing tanks. And so they were not the most confidence-inspiring of vehicles to go into a shooting war in. Anyway, the glider-borne brigade and a parachute brigade, the two out of the three brigades forming the 1st Airborne Division, set off with the gliders being towed by Troop Carrier Command, American aircrew. And nobody really told them, or they hadn't understood anyway that people get hurt in a war. There's a lot of noise, and it's very frightening. The wind was blowing offshore, and it was they were still some way out over the Mediterranean when flak started coming up, and this was very alarming. And unhappily, a great number of the tug pilots had too much and pulled the plug out and went back home to North Africa. And the gliders they were towing couldn't reach the land, went down into the drink, and we had some hundreds of troops drowned. Well, this was pretty awkward, really. Actually, the airborne mission set out to do was accomplished, but at a wholly unacceptable cost. Well, in the base back there, waiting things to come in, I heard that Hoppy had been shot down. At least he'd been dumped in the drink, but they'd destroyed, fished him out. And these, our own glider pilots, such of them as were got out of the Mediterranean, were they were being brought in ones and twos here now, looking for an American throat to cut. It was really quite a tricky time, and I had a bit of a problem there, because however bad they were then, they were going to learn, and we were bound in the airborne business to depend upon American troop carrier command to get us into the war from then on. We hadn't the aircraft of our own. And something had to be done to prevent an explosion which would make the cooperation between us very, very difficult in the future. So as the glider pilot came in, I confined them all to camp, put them all under arrest, really. They were all confined to camp. And I kept them locked up until the American tug pilots had been paraded, congratulated on their gallantry, received awards for their bravery. And they're such good chaps, the glider pilots. I mean, I'm the president patron of the Glider Pilot Regiment Association in this country. I know them well. Very, very good people. And when they saw what it was all about, they said, oh, well, with a whole lot of unquotable observation, they said, well, we'll let them get on with it. And, of course, they turned out in the end to be very good, the troop carrier command, but that was a bad beginning. So, anyway, my brigade was then the one chosen to do the landing at Taranto in southern Italy. And so I went up to Algiers to get my instructions for this, and there weren't any aircraft, so we were going by sea. Very good, we were going in one United States and one British cruiser, USS Boise from the United States, and HMS Penelope, that very gallant ship. And they were going to take us in, and we were going to land in the harbour, just like that. So I went up to Algiers, to Allied Forces headquarters, to the planners, and I said, well, I know what the idea is, but you tell me, is this going to be an opposed landing? And the reply I got roughly added up to, well, we'll find out when you get there. Oh, come, I said, if it's going to be an opposed landing, we're going to need air support, gun support, naval gunfire. We're going to need landing craft. They said, well, don't waste our time. There aren't any landing craft anyway. They've all gone to the Far East. So you could just get off up there and do the best you can. So I call this an anemorphous skylark landing. Off we went in HMS Penelope and USS Boise. And I was taking along Popsky instead, who turned up there. Nobody knew what to do with Popsky, but I reckon I did. So they gave me Popsky's little unit, the private army, well known as such by them. And we put him down in Sicily under 1st Airborne Division to do a really excellent job of reconnaissance and occasional hard crust stuff in southern Italy. And he was worth his weight in gold there, lending an element of colour to what became, after a while, a pretty drab operation, fighting up the soft underbelly of Europe. Popsky lent it quite a lot of glamour in a small way, cheered people up. And we went ashore on the quay. Early that morning, from the bridge of HMS Penelope, I'd watched the Italian battle fleet steaming out of Taranto under the